Call this matter up. It's docket number 79699, A.M. Rivas versus the center. And Mr. Eisenberg has indicated he's going to reserve 5 minutes. So, Mr. Eisenberg, you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert Eisenberg appearing for the appellant, and Dr. Reeves, it's pronounced Reeves.
Reeves.
I'm looking for key words in reports. Defense counsel must circle in the report where those words are located. Those are quotes from Judge Scotti expressing his narrow view that experts are tethered to their reports when they're testifying at trial, and that he would look for keywords that can be circled in a report. This court does not have any published opinions on this issue, but there is an unpublished opinion a couple years ago, Abdullah, which holds that experts are not tethered to their reports when they're testifying at trial. Case law from around the country establishes that experts are not required merely to read their reports while testifying, that they're allowed to explain, elaborate, and expand on things in their reports to give the jury a complete evidentiary view of what those opinions are. This was an expert-driven case, and Judge Scotti limited the defense experts, three of them. Now, because of my time limitation, there's no way I can get into the details of all three of those expert doctors, but I would like to highlight just three or four things. First, one of the doctors was going to testify about stomach wall. Well, there was an objection that the word stomach wall was not in the doctor's report. Judge Scotti sustained the objection, would not allow the doctor to testify. Well, the report was replete with references to gastric, the word gastric, which is a medical word for stomach, and it referred to this gastric wall. So it was in the report. Another expert was going to testify about the contrasts that are used in CT scans. There's IV contrast, and then there's oral contrast. And Judge Scotti ruled that those terms were not in the expert's reports, and therefore the expert could not explain them. Well, both of the reports had specifically referred to the CT scans. And so it was merely an elaboration on what was in the reports. Another one, there was a reference to what's called SIRS, S-I-R-S, which is an acronym for a syndrome that leads to sepsis. It's a precursor for sepsis. The judge ruled that because the word SIRS was not in the report, the doctor would not be allowed to use it and to explain it, even though defense counsel explained to the judge that it was simply a precursor to sepsis. It was just one of the steps leading to sepsis. Then the final one I wanted to point out has to do with a medication called vasopressors. Mrs. Center had extremely low blood pressure. She was given the medication vasopressors, which is to treat low blood pressure. One of the doctors was asked about vasopressors and whether Mrs. Center received them. There was an objection, and the judge precluded the testimony about vasopressors, even though the topic of low blood pressure was, in fact, in the doctor's report. In fact, it was in there multiple times. So these are just examples of where the judge was tethering these experts to words and phrases that were not in their reports. We believe this was prejudicial. This was a close case. This was an expert-driven case. The jury deliberated 2 days. They were split 6-2. And this limitations imposed by the judge could have easily tipped the scale to go the other way on the verdict. The next issue that I wanted to address is what I refer to as the Peruzzi issue. Under Nevada law, in medical malpractice cases, absent parties who are not defendants at trial are still included on the verdict form, and so that the jury can apportion negligence to those absent defendants. And I call it the Peruzzi issue because there's a case, Nevada Supreme Court case Peruzzi, which says the jury should be instructed and the absent defendant should be on the verdict form. In this case, a plaintiff's own doctor testified that the three settling defendants who were not defendants at trial, the three settling defendants, all three of them, were negligent. Their conduct was beneath the standard of care, and their negligence caused and contributed to Mrs. Sanders' injuries. I'm sure this...
Mr. Eisenberg, that was Dr. Savlak, and he was testifying as a standard of care expert against Dr. Siddiqui. Now, at the end of the day, the jury came back, and they clearly disbelieved the plaintiff's expert on direct that Dr. Siddiqui fell below the standard of care. They gave a 0% negligence. Couldn't it follow then that on cross-examination, they gave them the same determination of credibility of what you're talking about here, that they just say that it's they disbelieved the cross as well as the direct in this case? And isn't the verdict forms actually more consistent with that?
Well, I don't think it's really accurate to say that the jury disbelieved Dr. Savlak on that point. Dr. Siddiqui had presented a full defense at trial, expert witnesses testifying on his behalf. As I recall, he testified on his behalf. So there was plenty of evidence that he was not negligent. Dr. Savlak's testimony, particularly regarding the three other absent doctors, was completely uncontested. And I'm sure this court has a lot of lawyers standing before you telling you something is uncontested. In this case, it truly was regarding these three doctors. And Mr. Brensky even, for the most part, admitted that it was uncontested. And it truly was regarding all three of those doctors. So I disagree with your observation that the verdict form was consistent with that. The jury disregarded that jury instruction in the verdict form. I also wanted, I have about 2.5 minutes left, and I wanted to touch on the issue of attorney's fees. This was, I would say, a bizarre situation, to say the least. An offer of judgment for $1 million that resulted in an award of attorney's fees for approximately $850,000. It was an offer of judgment that we believe the evidence clearly shows was not properly served. And there were two aspects of the failure to serve properly. The offer of judgment was served through the district court's e-delivery service. And in order to do that, there's a default where it serves all of the lawyers of record. If a lawyer wants to delete somebody from the service, somebody has to manually go through and uncheck boxes. And in this case, a secretary from plaintiff's counsel's office manually unchecked 3 boxes for Mr. Doyle, who was lead counsel. Everybody knew he was lead counsel. And then after manually unchecking those 3 boxes, which guaranteed that Mr. Doyle would not receive service of the offer of judgment, then the same secretary, moments later, filed a certificate of service where she swore that the offer of judgment was served on Mr. Doyle. Now, it's true that there was local counsel, Ms. Mendelbaum. But what they established, and this was also uncontested, that if Ms. Mendelbaum received a document and the certificate of service showed that it was served on Mr. Doyle, he didn't bother duplicating it and reserving. And Mr. Brensky, plaintiff's counsel, has never contended that the Mendelbaum firm improperly relied on the false and misleading certificate of service. So we contend that even though in a normal case it might be okay to serve one lawyer when a party has two lawyers on the case, in this particular service, where the in this particular case, where the service of the offer of judgment failed in two regards, first, intentionally removing Mr. Doyle from the service list and then filing a false certificate of service, and then the district court relied on the certificate of service and awarded $850,000 in attorney's fees based on an offer of judgment that Mr. Doyle never saw, Dr. Reeves never saw, Dr. Reeves' insurance company never saw until after the trial and Mr. Brensky moved for attorney's fees. Well, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time if I could.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Brensky?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. It's of critical importance for the court to understand what happened in this case, so I have to give a brief synopsis of what occurred. I will advise the court that 5 years ago today, this very day, my client, Vicki Center, was in an intensive care unit at the hospital with a ventilator saving her life. She had gone in to see Dr. Reeves with regards to a hernia repair that was, it was an outpatient procedure. All the tests that were done show that her everything was normal except for the fact that she had a hernia. On the 6th of February of 2015, she went into surgery with Dr. Reeves. She came out of that surgery that morning after a very short period of time after the hernia repair with what's called a Nissan fundoplication. At that time, in the PACU, at the post-anesthesia care unit, is the first time that Dr. Reeves was advised that there was a problem. And in fact, the nurses in the PACU called Dr. Reeves because of my client's condition. Over the next 30 hours, my client's condition deteriorated so drastically that by the next evening, she coded. She died and had to be revived and put on a ventilator. In that some 40 hours, the following things took place. There were Dr. Reeves and Dr. Siddiqui were paid seven times with regards to her condition. Her pain level was 10 out of 10. Almost every time it was listed, there were 13 occasions that the nurses listed her pain level. Her blood pressure was severely low. She had three boluses of saline added to her IV to try to keep her blood pressure up. Her heart rate was at 142 over 77. Her condition was grave from the beginning of her being out of that surgery to the time that she coded. So if you look at the time frame that existed and what occurred, by the morning of the 7th, that's the very next morning, they did an examination of her abdomen. There was rebound tenderness in all quadrants. There was no bowel sounds. She was in very bad shape. In fact, Dr. Siddiqui at that time, at 10 a.m. that morning, ordered a CT of the abdomen because of his grave concerns over her condition. By 11 o'clock that morning, Dr. Reeves had appeared at the bedside, had ordered the Foley catheter to be removed because he was going to discharge her, even though the urine output was zero. Her creatinine level was at 1.6. She was in renal failure, and he canceled the CAT scan. By 4 p.m. that afternoon, she was going into her condition was so bad that Dr. Siddiqui sent her to the ICU to see Dr. Lin. Dr. Lin ordered a CAT scan stat. We don't know why it wasn't done till the next day, and did a bronchoscopy the following morning. The testimony of Dr. Felix and of Dr. Savlock was that Dr. Reeves fell way below, miles below the standard of care by not taking this patient back to surgery by 1 p.m. at the latest 4 p.m. on the 7th. None of the physicians that treated this woman who were on the verdict form treated the woman until after all of this occurred. And Dr. Felix testified, and I've got it here, that had he gone back in within the standard of care, none of the subsequent treatment would have been necessary, and she would have been out of the hospital. Dr. Savluck said the very same thing. When it comes to the criticisms by Dr. Savluck of Dr. Siddiqui and the later physicians that treated her after this horrible event, they were, A, that Dr. Siddiqui should have talked to Dr. Reeves about him canceling the CT the afternoon or the morning of the 7th. It turned out at trial that Dr. Siddiqui was not aware that Dr. Reeves canceled the CT. Dr. Lynn, the later doctor, ordered a CT stat. So the later physicians really had nothing to do with the standard of care and falling below that standard of care. When it came to Dr. Savluck, who was criticizing the later physicians, his criticism was that these physicians should have known something was wrong, and they should have gone to the chief of surgery and asked the chief of surgery to go back in. At the trial, Dr. Reeves testified he was the chief of surgery at the hospital at that time. So, if the court would follow what the appellant asks for, that would mean in every medical malpractice case that I or any other plaintiff's attorney has, we would have to call a settling defendant doctor to the stand to testify that he felt did not fall below the standard of care, and that's not what Peruzzi says. These doctors were put on the verdict form. The jury had every opportunity, had they seen fit, to find them at fault, but there really was no evidence to that. The evidence was overwhelming. There was a mountain of evidence of the breaches of the standard of care by Dr. Reeves and his ability, and only his ability, to go back in and rectify the holes that he put in the stomach at the time of the surgery. The defense experts' reports, for counsel to say that the experts were tethered is just not true. If you look at the expert reports, whether it's by Dr. Morton or Dr. Lamba or Dr. Cello, if you look at what they did, in fact, it's very interesting if you look at it. Dr. Lamba is trying to get in some expert opinion that's nowhere contained in his report, that's not within miles of it, and I object that opinion was never given. The judge looks at Dr. Lamba and says, Dr. Lamba, is this opinion in your report? He says no. He does that twice. When it comes to Dr. Morton, the surgeon, he has two opinions. He has one, that the NG tube that was inserted 4 days after this young lady coded caused the holes in the stomach, which we proved with the films that the holes were there prior to her coding. I mean, and that the NG tube was done 4 days later. What the defendant was trying to do in this case was to try to shoehorn additional opinions. When counsel talks about the stomach wall, yes, the word gastric wall is there, but they wanted a whole new opinion about how the stomach wall must have been weakened by the surgery procedure itself, which would allow the NG tube to somehow get through the stomach wall. None of that was contained in there. When it comes to contrasts, Dr. Morton was able to discuss CT contrast at length. There was nothing contained in Dr. Morton's report about, well, oral versus IV, and the judge gave him great latitude in that area. When it comes to the term SIRS, I can't tell you to this day what SIRS is. SIRS is not contained in any of the expert reports. In fact, it was almost comical. We're at the sidebar, and Ms. Denke starts grabbing her cell phone to try to show the judge what SIRS is, because it's not contained in any of the expert reports. So for the appellant to say that the experts were tethered is just untrue. A very cursory review of the testimony of the physicians compared to the testimony of the reports shows that they were given great latitude. This case, when it comes, let's talk about the attorney fees very briefly, because that's rather important. The Supreme Court Rule 42.1 specifically indicates that you must serve an offer of judgment on local counsel. In fact, had I served the offer of judgment on Mr. Doyle, Supreme Court Rule 42.1 may be read that it was not an effective service. So whenever we do offers of judgment, and we served offers of all the defendants on the same day, we only serve the counsel for the defendant that offer, because you don't want the court to find out somehow, some way that offers are out. You don't necessarily want the other defendant's lawyers to know about offers of judgment. So every good lawyer makes sure that the offers of judgment go to local counsel. And that's what we did, and 42.1 is exactly what we followed. Now, we readily admit that the certificate is wrong. However, there's no deliberately misleading on the part of my employee, who was very interested about how this case is going to turn out. When we argued this in front of the judge, we showed the judge 42.1. We showed the judge a case directly on point, which is Daniel International Corporation versus Fishback and Moore Inc., which is 916 F second 1061. It's a Fifth Circuit opinion in 1990, where exactly the same issue occurred. They served local counsel, but they didn't serve trial counsel. And that court came to the conclusion that the party properly served it, and that it was not deliberately misleading. It may be misleading, but it's not deliberately misleading. What confounds me in this case is local counsel, Ms. Mandelbaum, who's on the pleading page of every document, who is local counsel for Dr. Reeves, somehow the appellant would like that obligation by the counsel not to inform the client of an offer of judgment. Well, that's not what the rule says. Also, it cannot be, as an aside, in this case, when you have a medical malpractice case and you serve the physician must give consent before an insurance company can pay any money. In this case, Dr. Reeves had not given consent when we sent the offer of judgment. I did not know until 2 days before the end of trial that Dr. Reeves had finally given consent, and I only got that because I mentioned to trial counsel, I can't believe that Dr. Reeves didn't give consent, and in fact, counsel goes, oh yeah, well, he gave it last week. They never told me about it. They hid that from me. So the first thing I did was send a demand for the policy limits in writing to the defense insurance company. They ignored it. Had Mr. Doyle been given notice, our position is that never would have made a difference. They never intended to pay a dime in this case. They never offered a dime in this case. We properly served under 42.1. Was the certificate wrong? Yes, we readily admit that. But that does not relieve the responsibility of the attorney for the party to make that information known. No, and we cited Lang versus Hickman, where it says a notice to an attorney is notice to the client. So the case law is clear. When it comes to the attorney fees, the counsel didn't discuss it much, but when you take a medical malpractice case to trial, and when we got this case, we knew it would be expensive. I think our costs in this case were at least $200,000. The time and effort and expense that we put into this case, we were well aware of. When the court looked at the case using the Beatty factors, the court was aware that the defense, Dr. Reeves' defense in this case, was that an NG tube 4 days after my client coded caused the hole in the stomach instead of the surgical procedure that occurred the morning before. The other defense, I promise you, it sounds ridiculous. The other defense was that when they were bag masking my client, somehow that caused a hole in her stomach, which is unheard of. So the defenses that were brought by the appellant were what I would call not particularly valid. And it would be so obvious to anybody looking at this record to see that Dr. Reeves had an obligation to go back. I mean, the woman had a surgery on her stomach. She codes the following evening, and he did nothing about it other than cancel the CT that might have helped. And when the nurse, you know, you look at these nurses' notes, the nurses' notes show, at one point in time, the nurse states, and I'll just quote it, notified Dr. Reeves of patient's pain level, what medications were already given and where the pain's located, left side of abdomen, radiating to shoulders, order received for Norco PRN, and encourage ambulation and deep breathing. Dr. Reeves states the pain is due to the air under the diaphragm. Asked Dr. Reeves if pain continues to be 10 out of 10 after additional medication given, if he wants to call him back. Answer, he stated no. This is a doctor that it's unconscionable. The evidence is so dramatic. It's so unconscionable what this physician did. And all of the experts for the respondent, for my client, testified that all of this, the fact that my client had to have her feet amputated, could have been resolved long before any of these other doctors treated the patient. If the court has any questions, I've got 7 seconds. I don't need them.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Colleagues, any other questions for Mr. Brensky? Okay, hearing none, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. I attempted to unmute this. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Just a few points that I'd like to make. First, this is not the forum to retry the case, and we're not asking court to retry the case. So all of the evidentiary issues that counsel has brought up, for the most part, are irrelevant to the legal issues that we've raised in the appeal. But I did want to touch on a couple of things. First, there was evidence that the patient had improvement in 6 or 7 different areas of her physical condition during the days after the surgery. And the evidence was pretty much uncontested that if a patient has sepsis as a result of a hole in the stomach, that sepsis cannot improve. It cannot until the hole is repaired. It's called source repair. It's like a hole in the tire of your car. It's going to continue leaking until it's repaired. And so the fact that there was improvement during those days tended to show that there was no hole in the stomach and that the initial problems were caused by something else. Additionally, counsel has kind of, to some extent, harped on the fact that Dr. Reeves canceled a CT early on. Well, as he explained at trial, he was told by the nurse that the CT was ordered, I think, by Dr. Siddiqui, because there was a suspicion that Mrs. Setter had internal bleeding. And when the blood tests and the other diagnostic tests showed that she did not have bleeding, then, of course, he canceled the CT scan. I wanted to respond to counsel's comment that, for Dr. Lamba, that the judge asked, is this opinion in your report? And Dr. Lamba said no. My recollection, and I don't have the transcript right here, but my recollection is that what the judge asked is, are these words in your report? Is this phrase in your report? And the doctor said no. But the gist of what he was talking about was certainly in his report. Issue about the stomach wall, I mean, really, what the objection was not that the doctor was expressing a new opinion regarding the stomach wall. What the specific objection at trial was that the words stomach wall are not in the report. The judge looked for it. I think that's the situation where he said to defense counsel, circle it if you can. And the word stomach wall wasn't in the report. So the judge said, well, it's not coming in. And then finally, as far as the attorney's fee issue, the respondents have not cited any case from any jurisdiction in the country where there was a false, inaccurate, misleading certificate of service for an offer of judgment, but nevertheless, the court awarded attorney's fees, particularly almost or more than $750,000. Now, you have to ask yourself, why did the person at counsel's office delete Mr. Doyle's firm 3 different times, intentionally unchecking? Why did the same person file a false certificate of service saying that Doyle was served? By filing and serving that false certificate of service, the employee at Mr. Brensky's firm was essentially telling Ms. Mendelbaum's firm, don't worry, we served Doyle. And essentially saying, you don't need to worry about that. We served him. And that was simply untrue. Then the final thing I wanted to mention is Mr. Brensky talks about a conversation that he had with Mr. Doyle in the courtroom off the record. I don't remember seeing that in the transcript. Maybe it's there somewhere. I don't believe it is. And that's not something on which this court should rely in affirming the award of attorney's fees. Unless the court has any questions for me, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. And colleagues, do you have any questions for Mr. Eisenberg?
I don't. Thank you.
Justice Silver?
No, thank you, Chief Presiding.
Okay. Mr. Eisenberg, Mr. Brensky, thank you for the excellent briefing in this matter. This matter will stand submitted, and the case will stand in recess, or the court will stand in recess until the next call of the court. Thank you.